Welcome, everybody. This is the eighth and final office hours session for the Mises Academy class, Mises on Money and Banking, which is our quick tour of the theory of money and credit. This was offered in the beginning of 2012, in case future aliens find this recording and want to know what the heck it is. And we've got two good questions right out of the chute. So let's go ahead and get started. Lewis asks, does the subsistence fund consist of consumer goods only? Does it also include capital goods? Off the top of my head, I don't remember exactly what Mumbaverick thought of the subsistence fund. Before I answer your direct question, let me mention something. So Mises points out in Human Action, and presumably he mentioned it earlier in his career, but I know for sure he talks about in Human Action, that actually the term subsistence fund is a bit of a misnomer, because it's the term subsistence fund makes it sound like this is what's the bare minimum necessary to sustain the workers during this production period while they're waiting for the next batch of consumer goods to come through the pipeline, right? So you're paying the workers right now, some of them, to go out and, let me try to think of something that works. It's hard because most of the stuff we consume isn't necessary for survival. You're giving them ham sandwiches right now, and they're eating that while they're raising baby pigs, if you get what I'm going for there, right? So it's going to take some time before the work that the workers are doing today will yield more ham. And so in order for that to work, you know, you can't just say to the workers, well, don't eat for 3 months. Because, you know, you'll just bide your time, and then 3 months from now, the stuff you're doing today will really pay off. And then you'll have a bunch of ham sandwiches, you'll have apples from the stuff that you're planting. You wouldn't have in 3 months, but you get what I'm saying. So the whole point of the Bamberkian approach is to say what we do in a modern economy, a capitalistic economy, is the owners of the what's called the original factors of production, the owners of raw labor power and the owners of natural resources, they devote their inputs in the processes that take some time before they yield consumption goods. And so the only way that can work is if they're already, from past production processes, are a stockpile of consumer goods that will tide them over while we wait for this new production process to bear fruit. In some cases, literally, if we're talking about, food producing processes, and then metaphorically if we're talking about building a shower or something, or a irrigation ditch to bring water to the city. So Mises points out that it's what Bumbaverick has in mind, of course, especially in a modern capitalistic economy, is not just subsistence, it's rather all of the goods, how can I put it? The workers have to be given, and it's not just workers, all the factor owners, so the people who own the land, even the people who own the coal mines, right, because this also would include depletable natural resources. Everybody who must be convinced by the capitalists to trade away their input, so that they can be used by the capitalists in a long-term process, those people have to be compensated enough to make them willing to do that so that they don't want to use their original property in some other way that yields its result sooner. So so the point is, Mises is saying, it's not really that it's subsistence or not. So it's true, physically, there has to be at least enough stuff in this fund to offer the bare subsistence, right? It just wouldn't work. Society would collapse if we didn't have enough food and shelter and clothing to literally keep the workers alive for the what's called the period of production. Obviously, that wouldn't work, because then starting next period, a bunch of the workers would be dead, and a bunch of the farm owners would be dead, and so on. So, yeah, the fund that we have in mind here has to be at least a subsistence fund, but actually it needs to be such that the standard of living that it affords all the factor owners, including the workers, is attractive enough that they're happy with the bargain, right? So if it weren't enough, then, so in other words, given the trade-off, given the stream of consumption over time that the workers and the other factor owners thought they would be able to get in this arrangement, they might decide, you know, it's just not enough. I would rather reconfigure what we're doing to front load my consumption. Because that's always the trade-off, that if you're willing to defer consumption and invest your resources in longer projects, the yield from them will be higher if we disregard the time element. So in a sense, you could say your lifetime consumption will be higher, but the point is it will be spread out more into the future. So it's exactly analogous to if you have just a bunch of money right now and you're trying to determine what to do. Let's say you have $10,000 in actual cash. And so what could you do with it? Well, you could spend it right now and get $10,000 worth of consumption today. Or you could lend it out at interest, and let's say the interest rate's 5%, you could then start consuming $500, what did I say, 10,000? Yeah, you could start consuming $500 worth of consumption every year indefinitely. So as long as you live long enough, you're eventually going to get more than 10,000 worth of consumption, and then everything at that point is gravy. But the point is, you know, it's, you got to wait for it. So there's a trade-off involved. It obviously doesn't follow that everyone should save every last penny, because then you would never get to consume. You would just keep accumulating and having this exponentially growing principal in your name, and you'd never get to enjoy it. Or maybe you would consume the bare minimum to keep yourself alive, but that would be stupid too. So you know, everybody would be a multimillionaire on their deathbed, and then what? Right before they died, would they go out on a cruise and get a bunch of heroin and go gambling? I mean, you see the point? So Misha says that's really the trade-off, and so to use this term subsistence fund is a little bit misleading, because it makes it sound like this is a physiological thing when it's not. It has to do with intertemporal preferences, and there's no reason that the workers and other factor owners would arrange their affairs such that in the present they're getting just the bare minimum to survive. Now, the reason Bombaver used that phrase is he wanted to stress the primacy of saving being necessary, being logically antecedent to economic growth. Bombaver wanted to show, if you want to become more capitalistic, if you want to enhance the productivity of labor by accumulating more machinery, if you want to make production processes more physically productive so that for a given amount of inputs, you know, this much fertilizer, this much farmland, this much iron ore, this much labor of a certain skilled quantity or skilled amount, and so on, that we get more consumption goods shooting out, well, it's necessary for some people to abstain from potential present consumption and build up these inventories of goods to get everyone over the hump. That's just physically necessary. That's what he was trying to get across. Okay, so now back to Lewis's excellent question. Does the subsistence fund consist of consumer goods only? Well, I think that's the way most people are thinking about it, that it's just this big stockpile of goods for the owners of original factors to keep them going. But I mean, The other complication in all this is that it's we tend to, in its simplest, most or crudest form, you're thinking of everything as being in these discrete chunks. So it's like, oh, right now it's time zero or time one, however you want to start the thing, and everybody is going to plow their inputs, you know, so the workers are going to put their labor hours, the people who own farmland are going to start planting seeds, and the owners of coal mines are going to take some of it, some of the coal, and hand it over to the capitalist. Everyone's going to put it into this process that's going to take X number of years to come to fruition, and then and they're going to keep doing that every year, right? So every year you start another X period process, so that finally when you get over that hump, now boom, you start, you know, in year T plus X, you now reap the benefits of what you did in period one or period zero, however you want to do the baseline. And then the next period, T plus X plus one, you're reaping the benefits of the X year process that you started in period two, and so on. But in reality, of course, that's not how it works, right? It's not that everything is all synchronized and everybody at a given moment is pouring all of their resources and inputs into this one long thing that then shoots out a bunch of heterogeneous goods. You know, it's under this one giant six-year process that all workers and other labor or factor owners dump their resources in at time one, and then 7 years from now, out from the single process pops forth a bunch of tuna fish, a bunch of skim milk, a bunch of 2% milk, a bunch of cars, a bunch of radios. You get the point. So that's one problem with this very crude approach. And so when you start making it more realistic, it gets a little bit trickier. So so strictly speaking, yeah, I would think the subsistence fund, if you're viewing it as what are the work, let me put it this way. I think the principle that survives all this, when you start trying to make it, tweak it and make it more realistic, is that the capitalists are allowing the workers to consume present goods rather than having to wait around for their proportional share of the output, the consumption good output that is due to their efforts today. And that's really, that was a brilliant aspect of Bombardier's critique of the Marxist exploitation theory of interest. So the Marxists said that the capitalists were skimming off the top, taking the surplus value from the production process that the workers were generating. And the idea was that, you know, if you just think about it, year after year, there's a bunch of stuff that is produced, like the national income, if you will. And so the workers get some of it, and the owners of the farmland get some of it, and the owners of the coal mines and diamond mines get some of it. But there's also this group of people we call the capitalists, and what exactly did they do? And from a technological point of view, it looks like they did absolutely nothing. So you understand why what the workers did. They had to show up at the factories and engage in backbreaking labor. You understand what the owners of the farmland contributed. I mean, you could object and say it's not fair that they happen to own that, that maybe the farmland should be distributed to everybody, but the point is, physically, you understand why it's necessary that the farmland was part of the production process and the role that it played. And you can say the same thing for the coal mine owner and the, you know, diamond mines and all, everybody. But the one group that seems like just a bunch of parasites are the capitalists. So, yeah, in a market economy, they're necessary because they control the money. And they have the financing, and you need to get dollars or euros or whatever in order to hire workers and to buy the materials. But from a technological point of view, it doesn't seem like they're actually doing anything. and yet they get to consume year after year. So the Marxists were saying there's a sense in which these capitalists are just skimming off the top, and if we could drive the rate of interest down to zero, then they wouldn't be able to do that. See how that works? Because the capitalists, they have their wealth, and then the rate of interest is sort of like showing what percentage of their capital value every year do they get to consume just as pure income without diminishing their overall net worth. And so if the interest rate were zero, then, yeah, the capitalists would still have that stockpile of wealth, but if they consume some of it, then they would be that much poorer next year. Whereas a positive interest rate, in a sense, means you can multiply that by the person's net worth, and then that's how much they can consume this year free and clear without making themselves poorer next year. Right, so if you have $1 million in the bank, or if you have $1 million in financial capital in stocks or in physical machinery that's in a business or whatever, and then you figure out what's the rate of return I earned on that, what that really means is that's the income I've earned this year. And what does that mean? Well, among other ways of interpreting it, it means that's how much you could consume, and next year your financial net worth would still be the same as it was this year. Okay. So what Bombaberg pointed out in responding to this challenge was to say this is ignoring the difference between present and future goods and how there's a higher valuation placed on present goods. Because it's not true to say that, sorry, let me, there's one other thing. And so this is how, so the Marxists, when they say they want the workers to get the full value of their product, that's partly what they had in mind. That they're saying there's a sense in which the workers and other factor owners are producing 100% of the output, and yet they're actually only getting paid in wages when they go to the store. What the heck? They're clearly not consuming everything of what their efforts produced, because they can't be, because the group of capitalists are getting fancy cars and eating caviar and smoking cigars and having wild parties. So clearly, some of the total output every year is getting redirected into this group's hands when we know they didn't physically contribute to its creation. So clearly, everybody else who actually made the stuff is only getting a fraction of what they produced. And so that's part of this Marxist critique, saying the workers should get the full value of their product or of their labor. I don't remember the exact way they phrased it. So what's funny is, or what's neat, is Bombaberg didn't come along and challenge that. He said, no, that's a bad principle. He said, yeah, I agree with you. And guess what? That's exactly what happens in a market economy because of competition. The workers do get paid the full value of their product. He said, but what you need to keep in mind is present goods are more valuable than future goods. And so when a worker, for example, today digs a ditch that 3 years from now is going to be the hole where a basement is of a new house that's sold, the worker right now can't get paid enough money to be the proportional share of that new house in 3 years. So let me back up. Let's say it takes, over the course of 3 years, let's say it's going to take, I'm just making this up, I have no idea, 10,000 labor hours, all things considered, to make this new house. And then the house is going to end up having a sale price of $100,000. And assume the workers are interchangeable, even though in reality, you know, it doesn't take a skilled guy to dig holes in the ground, whereas it takes somebody pretty skilled to draw the blueprints, you know, to design, the architect to design the house is probably going to get paid more per hour than the guy digging the ditch, but forget that for the moment. Assume all the workers are interchangeable and it takes 10,000 labor hours to make the house and no other factor inputs. Again, we're being completely ridiculous with these assumptions because, of course, you need to have guys who own timber to sell you the woods if you're going to build a wood house and that kind of thing. But just keep it simple. Assume over a 3-year period it takes a total of 10,000 labor hours to make this brand new house that's going to then at that time be sold for $100,000. And so the Marxists would claim the workers are the ones who built that house, by assumption, in this example. There's no other contribution from anybody else. It's just raw labor power over time that transforms this empty plot of land into a brand new house that's going to be sold for $100,000. So clearly, the workers collectively ought to be paid $100,000 if they're getting paid the full value of their product. And if we further stipulate, unrealistically, that the workers are all interchangeable and no one worker's more talented than the other, they should all get paid the same. And so every hour ought to be getting $10, right? Because it takes 10,000 labor hours to make the thing, it sells for 100,000. So the Marxists, looking at the guy in the beginning who spends 8 hours digging the ditch, they're thinking the capitalist should have to pay him $80. He should be getting paid $10 per hour. And he put in 8 hours digging that hole, which ultimately, you know, so when we calculated the 10,000 total hours required to build the new house, part of that calculation was, in the beginning, a bunch of workers had to be digging in the ground. So if everybody's got to get $10 an hour, he puts in 8 hours on that first day, he should get $80. And yet, that dirty, greedy capitalist doesn't get him $80. He only gives them, whatever, $75. And that happens systematically over the 3 years. Now the margin, as it gets closer, the workers who contribute, who put the finishing coat of paint on the house just before the thing is put on the market and sold for $100,000, those workers actually get paid something like $9.90 per hour. So not quite $10, but close. Whereas the workers in the beginning, they get paid much less than that, their hourly rate. And so so when the capitalists now sell the house for $100,000, they've, over the course of 3 years, paid out a lot less than $100,000 in wages, and that difference constitutes their interest on the capital they put into the project. So what Bombavich is saying is there's no exploitation going on there. He said if the workers really want to get the full value of their product, they can do that. All the workers can get together and say, we don't need those stinking capitalists. Let's just go out to this virgin land. And again, in this example, we assumed the land was a free good because we didn't want to have to deal with the difficulty of buying the land from somebody. And so the workers start digging the thing. The other workers come and pour in the concrete, and again, they make the concrete with their bare hands because they don't want to deal with the problems of how concrete is actually made. And over the course of 3 years, after 10,000 labor hours have been inputted, they sell the house for $100,000, and all the workers, per their original agreement, said, hey, we're all interchangeable, and we all split the proceeds evenly. And so now all the workers do get $10 for every hour they put into the project. Bombavich says, nobody's stopping them from doing that. They can do what they want, but why wouldn't they do that? Because that means the workers in the beginning who had to start digging the hole, yeah, they can write down on a piece of paper, I just worked 8 hours today, so that means when this house is sold, I'm going to get $80 of it. And they will, but the house isn't going to be ready for 3 years. So they're not earning $80 in present wages. What they've just tallied up for themselves is $80 to be payable when this house is finished 3 years from now by them putting in 8 hours digging the foundation today. So Bombavich is saying, sure, if you want the workers to get paid the full value of the product, by all means. And notice, when those workers get the wages from the capitalists today, which I think I said, $75 instead of 80, I forget what number I had. But given whatever the interest rate is, if those workers, so in other words, you might say, well, it's not fair. The workers don't get a choice to do that in the present day and age. But Bombavich pointed out, sure they do. If the worker really wants to have $80 when the house is sold, here's what he does. He takes his discounted wages that the capitalist gives him on day one. It's not $80. And then he goes and he lends it out through the banks. And then over the three-year period, whatever he got from the capitalist will grow into being worth exactly $80 at the time when the house is sold. because what the capitalist pays him is today's present discounted value of the $80 3 years from now. Okay, so everyone see how that works? So Mavrick is saying, now if the worker doesn't want to do that, if he can't wait 3 years and he wants to consume today, okay, he has the freedom to do that. And that's actually what happens in the typical practice. But don't complain that the worker's not getting paid the full value of his products. So Mavrick is saying, what the Marxists want is for the worker to get paid more than the full value of his product. They want him to be paid as if he just contributed, if every hour he contributes is 1/10,000th the value of a new house that's available right now. That's what it would mean if we gave him $10 an hour. But Mavrick said, what the worker on day one is producing is 1/10,000th of a house that won't be available for 3 years. And so then when you realize a house available immediately is more valuable than a house that won't be available for 3 years, well, 1/10,000th of that then, of the former good, is more valuable than 1/10,000th of the latter good. So I spent a lot of time on that, but I just wanted to really drive home the essence. So what the capitalists are doing is advancing present goods to the workers. So that's why Lewis, I am trying to answer your question here, that's why I think the subsistence fund should be thought of as consumption goods, because that's what their purpose is. It's allowing the workers to get paid the discounted present value of their efforts in consumption goods today, rather than the much larger quantity of consumption goods that their efforts actually will yield down the line. So if maybe what you had in mind was that, well, wouldn't the subsistence fund technically not just be ice cream, you know, tubs of ice cream for the consumer, but wouldn't it also include maybe the refrigeration and the electricity necessary to keep the ice cream from perishing for the next 2 weeks? And so, like, right now, wouldn't the subsistence fund include not just pure consumption goods, but also the associated capital goods to keep the subsistence fund from perishing? I mean, you could do it like that if you wanted to, but then you run into the problem of, like I said, there's overlapping cycles. I mean, you could just as easily say, no, the subsistence fund means what's available right now today for consumption, and then the ice cream tubs and the coolers and the grocery store and the electricity to keep the coolers running for ice cream that actually won't be bought until 8 days from now, that's not part of today's subsistence fund. That's part of the process of delivering ice cream to the consumer that will happen to yield its fruit 8 days from now. And so that's part of a prior cycle. You see the issue there? So I think conceptually, yeah, the subsistence fund should be just all consumption goods and services. Because if you start trying to make it realistic like you're doing, you're going to, I mean, it gets really complicated, and the problem is you don't really have a neat little, the period ends, all of the consumption goods shoot out of the pipeline, and then now we start a new thing that they're all overlapping in reality. Okay, let's see. Tom Miller says, and for people who are joining us, I see some people are having daylight savings issues, and what can I say except that the government strikes again. But please post questions for those of you who are logging in late, and I'll hit them too. Okay, Tom Miller says, from Lecture 7, Slide 11, it says, the issue of fiduciary media has made it possible to avoid the convulsions that would be involved in an increase in the objective exchange value of money. And then Tom asks, so that was a Mises quote from the book. And then he says, doesn't the above contradict what we have learned about the trade cycle? capital goods depreciate, so shouldn't that portion also be included? Or maybe Tom is. Tom, are you talking about the capital goods thing to go along with what I was saying about the subsistence fund? Or, okay. I think so. In case people are getting lost, so there's two things going on. Let me just answer this quick one first. So Tom Miller, I guess when I was talking about the subsistence fund, had asked, capital goods depreciate, so shouldn't that portion of the depreciating capital goods also be included, I guess, in the subsistence fund? I don't think so. I get what you're saying, but so yeah, to do the proper accounting, and if you were doing like a macro analysis and wanted to look at what's gross savings and what's net savings and stuff like that, yeah, you got to take into account depreciation. But I think, like I say, the purpose that this notion of subsistence fund serves in the Austrian tradition is to show that it's the function of what the capitalists do. And what they do is they allow the workers to consume the present discounted value of their efforts rather than having to wait for them to come to fruition. I guess you could be right, but my hunch is, without thinking about it too much, I don't think so. I think it's, yeah, it is true that the capitalists have to accumulate capital goods and we got to worry about depreciation and all that stuff, but I think it's, the workers don't directly care about depreciating capital equipment. What they care about is, I just put in some labor hours and I want to eat today. And I want to be able to go home to an apartment today. I don't want to have to wait for those things to come to fruition. And so the subsistence fund means somebody in the past has saved to make it possible today for the workers to consume immediately. Okay, so go back to Tom's earlier question. Mises saying about the issue of fiduciary media has made it possible to avoid the convulsions that would be involved in an increase in the objective exchange value of money. And so Tom is saying, doesn't that contradict what we learned about the trade cycle? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. And that's the problem in the modern disputes over Mises and his understanding of fiduciary media, and whether Mises would agree with the 100% reserve camp or whether Mises would agree with the so-called free banker camp. So it's, at the very least, Mises is confusing in the theory of money and credit on this issue. So I think any objective person would have to agree it's not crystal clear what Mises thought. In certain passages, it looks like he's saying fiduciary media served a very useful function and made the economy behave better than would have happened in the absence of fiduciary media. But in other places, Mises says stuff like fiduciary media contain the seeds of their own destruction. And he makes it look like the issue of fiduciary media per se causes the trade cycle. So let's assume there's not a contradiction. How might we reconcile those various scattered statements in the book? So again, I'm not saying this is my personal view as to what Mises was saying, but let's just assume Mises isn't contradicting himself, and let me try to show you how we could reconcile those two things. So what Mises is saying on that quote that you've reproduced there, as he's saying, historically, as what we refer to as Western civilization spreads around the world, right, the European powers basically set up colonies and their way of life sort of dominated most areas of the globe. More and more areas, more and more people were brought into the international division of labor, often with aggression and other unsavory things. So I'm not saying this was an unmitigated success story, but putting aside those other things, and also, by the way, Mises condemned like the British Empire and things in places, so it's not like Mises was naive about the white man taking over the world. But be that as it may, the spread of using gold as money and silver was amplified by this process, this historical event of the world being brought into one unified global marketplace where gold and silver were the base money, the commodity monies. So Mises is saying, if we had 100% reserves, there would have been a large increase in the demand to hold commodity money, and what the equilibrium outcome would have been that a lot of resources would have been devoted to digging up more gold and silver, and prices quoted in currencies that were tied in a fixed ratio to gold and silver, those prices would have had to drop significantly. And because as the demand for the money shot up and the supply didn't shoot up nearly enough, then the new equilibrium price, the purchasing power of those types of monies would have risen. So that means prices quoted in them or prices quoted in currencies that were in a fixed ratio with gold and silver weight would have dropped. And he's saying that would have caused convulsions. So other things equal, the economy's going along humming nicely, and all of a sudden the demand to hold money doubles just like that. That's going to cause economic disruptions. It's true the market eventually will sort things out and prices will fall significantly across the board, but the point is it's not just going to be a flawless little adjustment. It's going to cause convulsions. So Mises is saying in that context then, the ability of the commercial banks to give people a bunch of fiduciary media to hold sort of quenched this huge increase in the demand for money without it being necessary for the equilibrium price of money to rise, and without it being necessary for a bunch of resources to be devoted to bringing more gold and silver to the surface. And so he's saying, you know, that's just an undeniable fact. Now, it could simultaneously be true that anytime the banks issue fiduciary media, it makes the rate of interest lower than it otherwise would be and sets in motion the trade cycle. So there's two possibilities. One is that Mises, when he's talking about the issue of fiduciary media and causing the trade cycle, it's possible, and this is what the free bankers believe, that what he means is the banks issuing fiduciary media above and beyond what is necessary to compensate for an increase in the demand to hold money. So if that's the interpretation of his trade cycle theory, then it means there wasn't really inflation. And that's also why it's so critical where he defines inflation to mean an increase in the quantity of money or the supply of money above an increase in the demand. Because then you'd say, oh, see, there was no inflation. If the commercial banks merely offset the global increase in the demand to hold money, then there was no inflation, and so there's no trade cycle. Or you could still take Mises to say what Salerno and those guys think he's saying, that any increase in fiduciary media, period, causes the trade cycle. And so you could take Mises to merely be saying, in his judgment, as an empirical thing, it would have been more convulsive to have the world respond to this massive price deflation rather than to have it respond to the trade cycle that was set in motion from the commercial banks issuing all this fiduciary media. All right, so that you could, Mises could simultaneously believe both things, that it would have been, there would have been a huge convulsion if there had been no fiduciary media issued when the global demand to hold gold and silver went through the roof, and that other things equal, issuing fiduciary media sets in motion the trade cycle. You could believe both things. Okay. Jan says, you gave an example in an earlier class of two projects. One is hamburger stand and one is skyscraper building company. The latter is more interest rate sensitive. Is it the same thing as more roundabout? Well, and just to make sure people understand what he's talking about, I was trying to show how when interest rates change, it has a different effect on businesses depending on how long-term the project is. And so if, for example, if you're running, I don't know if I said a hamburger stand or a lemonade stand, but if you're running something that's real short-term that you're just going to get in and get out, that you're going to have your capital invested for a few days, and then you're going to sell all your goods and have your resources gone and just have the revenue sitting there. There, if the interest rate is 2% or 4% or 8%, it doesn't really matter that much because your money's only going to be tied up for a few days. In contrast, if you're going to buy a piece of property in downtown area, hire an architect, hire a bunch of people, come in, pour in concrete, and build this big skyscraper filled with apartment units, and then rent them out to tenants over a 25-year period and earn the rent on your apartments every month. Well, that sort of project that might take you $1 million to build, and then you start reaping $70,000 net in income every year from your tenants after you pay the electricity bills and the property taxes and all that stuff. That project is going to very critically depend on the interest rate as to whether you should go forward with it or not. So Jan's asking, this notion of a project being sensitive to interest rates, is that the same thing as calling one of them more roundabout? Well, it is in Mbombabert's framework, right? That's what he's trying to show, is that when people save more and then that makes the subsistence fund bigger, and then it also lowers interest rates, that gives a green light to entrepreneurs to engage in longer term projects because now we can physically do it, right? There's a bigger subsistence fund, so now we can tide the workers over while society evolves into a longer series of projects that are more physically productive if we disregard the time element. But there are problems historically with this notion of roundaboutness. So it's, you can't in general come up with a way to define in physical terms what makes a project more or less roundabout and have that match up nicely with, so that if we start assigning prices, that when we change the interest rate, it pushes people necessarily into wanting to do the more roundabout project. And so the issue here in terms of the history of economic thought is what's called the re-switching debate. And so if you go, if you just Google Robert Murphy, I think the re-switching question, I have a Mises Daily that goes through this pretty carefully. So there you'll see why you run into trouble trying to switch back and forth between what the financial markets and present value calculations and money terms leads you to do. And if you're trying to think that really what's going on is there's this physical stuff, and that one project is, in a physical sense, more roundabout than the other, and the interest rate kind of just pushes us into the right one, that you're not going to be able to maintain that, at least in certain contexts. And that my article on the reswitching question or the reswitching controversy explains what's going on there. Okay. We've only got about 5 minutes left. Actually, I'll go to 10 after because I logged in late, so I'll give you guys the full 60 minutes. Okay, so Jan says, savings is abstaining from consumption. When my income is 100 and I consume 80 and I use the 20 to pay off my old debt, is the 20 also saving? Would the answer be different if the 20 was payment of interest only on the debt, or if it was repayment of principal? Okay, let me answer for myself, meaning I'm not sure if you asked Joe Salerno or Guido Holtzman that they'd give you the same answers. So let me just be clear. I'm not necessarily claiming that what I'm about to say is the definitive Austrian position on this. I think that yes, and I think everybody agrees, saving is abstaining from consumption. So your income, by my definition, means how much could you consume without your debt going up. So when you say my income is 100 and I consume 80 and then I use the 20 to pay off my old debt, is the 20 also savings? I would say yes. And then you say, would the answer be different if the 20 was payment of interest only on the debt or if it was repayment of principal? Okay, so here this is where it gets tricky now. For sure, if it's paying down the principal, that's saving, no doubt about that, at least in my, from my perspective. Now you're saying, but what if I'm just like, you know, I owe $1,000 on my credit cards and my finance charges this month are $20. And so, you know, I get a paycheck of 100 and I use the 20 of it to pay the credit card companies. So that's not reducing how much I owe them. That's just me treading water. And you're asking, is that saving? It's no, because that really wasn't my income, right? If we define income as saying how much could I consume and not reduce my net worth, well, if it took $20 for me just to keep the credit card companies at bay and not have me owe them more money, well, then that's really not my income. Or it's not my net income. So here it gets a little bit confusing because in everyday layman terminology, you're thinking that your paycheck is your income and then, gee, what do I want to do with it? But I'm saying if you do it from an accounting point of view and you define income to mean how much could I consume without going deeper into debt, which is the flip side of saying, or which is the same thing as saying without reducing my net worth, then the finance charges you need to pay, that's part of your, that reduces your available income. So if you want, if, you know, that's real confusing for people, you could use the distinction of gross versus net, I suppose. You could say my gross income is 100, but my net income is really only 80 because I had to devote 20 of it just to tread water with respect to the debts that I owe to people. You could do that if you wanted. And then you could say that paying the 20 to the credit card companies is gross saving, but it's not net saving, if you want to do it that way. Okay. Jan says, is the inevitable result of today's printing another sudden crash or a long, slow depression which will eventually turn into a healthy growth once the market slowly readjusts? Well, the safe thing for me would be to say it could be either, so that way no matter what happens, I'm okay, right? but what I have said, because I'm aware of the convenience of setting up a non-falsifiable position, right? And now it's true, Austrian economics is not a predictive science. You know, Mises and others in the Austrian tradition have warned about the dangers of trying to imitate the physicists and why the social sciences are qualitatively different from the natural sciences and so on. And it's certainly true that what Mises calls the theorems of economics are not established through experimental observation and induction. So I'm not quibbling with any of that. I don't have a problem with that. But I think it would be a little bit, I don't know what term I want to use. I wouldn't feel comfortable just saying, oh, what Bernanke's doing is going to lead to a crash, and we're all screwed, and then if a big crash happens, we say, see, we told you. But if no crash ever comes, and the economy is kind of bad year after year, we say, oh, see, we told you, and then if 5 years from now, things are fine, everything goes back to normal, and there was never inflation. We say, ah, see, we told you, you know, in other words, I don't think we should be able to say whatever just happened is what we predicted, no matter what happens. That, I think, is not right. So if you want to say we make no prediction, we're just saying this is worse than it otherwise would be, so it's a counterfactual, okay, but then no matter what happens, we can't point it and say, see, we told you, because by your own logic, you're saying we can't observe what would have happened. So what we can say is no matter what, in an absolute sense, whether it's good or bad, just say, well, it would have been worse it would have been better had Bernanke done what we said. Okay, that's fine. But I think a lot of times these proponents of Austrian economics and the blogosphere and stuff, they like to be able to point to Ron Paul saying there's a housing bubble. They like to be able to point to Peter Schiff on CNBC arguing with people and saying, see, these guys called it. So what I'm just saying is if we want to have that sort of authority to say we know what's going on because we called this stuff, I think our calls should at least be falsifiable. So again, it doesn't mean that Austrian business cycle theory per se is falsifiable, but it does mean if you're going to apply it and say in the world markets right now, this is what's going on, and then if something happens that you're going to pat yourself on the back and say, see, it's because I had Austrian economics under my belt that I called that, I think these predictions should be possible to be wrong. So in that light, what I have done, Jan, is I said to people, if the monetary base, and I guess to be fair, you would want to say like as a share of GDP, not just an absolute term, but as a share of GDP, if the monetary base eventually goes back to what it was in 2007, and there has been no, you know, surge in price inflation, the price in, you know, CPI inflation, never gets above 3.5%, and unemployment can stay high but keeps trending down, and eventually we just kind of grow out of this and things just naturally unwind, and years just go by and it looks like we're back to normal. If that happens, then I am going to say I really don't understand how the Fed works and its relationship with the economy. Okay, so in my mind, that should be impossible, what I just described. So it's true, I have been a little bit jumping the gun with my worries about large price inflation, and you know, and I'm familiar with the fact that the BLS uses tricks to hide what price inflation really is and that kind of stuff. But I thought by this point it was going to be just bursting out so obviously that the government would have to, you know, admit that price inflation was 6%, even though it was really 12, you know, that kind of stuff. I didn't think they would still be able to say price inflation is whatever they say, 2% and change or 3% and change, depending on which measure you're looking at, and that wouldn't be such a ridiculous lie that people, you know, wouldn't even report it. So, but you still have all those massive trillion-plus in excess reserves in the banking sector. All right, so my predictions thus far were off in terms of the timing, but it's still, you know, the thing that I'm thinking the problem is still sitting there. It's like there's still the loaded gun, and it just hasn't been fired yet, whereas I thought people would have, through their expectations, would have anticipated it, and that would have been pricing the system more by now. So, like I said, the thing that I would, you know, I don't think Bernanke can get out of this situation without the dollar really depreciating significantly, and or without there at least being a humongous crash. Because what they could just reverse everything tomorrow, but that would totally destroy the banking sector. So I don't, which, you know, could cause a panic and people could rush to hold dollars, and so that might lead to a big price deflation. But my point is Bernanke's plan, where he says, no, we had to do that to avoid disaster, and we'll just let the economy slowly recover, and we'll just let all this stuff naturally unwind. We'll let the mortgage-backed securities mature, and the Fed's holdings will just kind of shrink over time back to normal. if they can do that and there's no humongous disruption in the macro economy, then to me, that would mean, yes, Austrian business cycle theory is logically coherent, but it's not a very useful guide to understanding the world. Because if Austrian business cycle theory is right, what Bernanke did should totally have screwed up the intertemporal structure of production to have interest rates this low for this long. If that doesn't set in motion a serious discoordination in the capital structure, then what would? Okay, why don't I do one more here? Let's see. Okay. Jan asks, do savings always equal investment? Okay, again here, there's going to be, differences depending on whom you ask, even in the Austrian camp. So for me, I think most economists would say yes to your question, but the mechanisms that they have in mind for how that equality would manifest itself are different. So for some people, it's like an accounting identity, that savings necessarily equals investment, just if you start playing with macro accounting identities, like Y equals C plus I plus G and that kind of stuff, and you start moving stuff around, that it just pops out savings has to equal investment. And that's what's actually funny. Keynes does that in the general theory. So a lot of people think that Keynes believed that, oh, there's leakages in the system, and sometimes if people save too much and businesses don't want to invest that much, that, oh, savings exceeds investment, and then Keynes thought the world blows up. Whereas we free market guys know that when people save more, it goes into the banks and they lend it out to businesses, and so savings equals investments, and we're, you know, the economy works, don't worry about it. And actually that's a little bit off. That Keynes believes savings necessarily equals investment, and it's actually the free market guys who often don't think that it necessarily equals it, and they just think there's an equilibration process that eventually brings those two things into equality. Whereas Keynes thinks mathematically they have to equal each other. So what, in case you're thinking that I'm just lying to you, because what Keynes has in mind is the interest rate might not work to do it. So if everybody starts saving a bunch and businesses, because of their bad animal spirits or whatever, don't feel like investing that same amount, it's true. Keynes doesn't think that, oh, just have the interest rate fall and that will make people save less and it will make businesses want to invest more, and so the interest rate just needs to keep falling until you get that equality, because, well, what if the interest rate, nominal interest rate, hit zero? It can't go any further. So this is Krugman's big deal, right? Krugman's saying when you're at the zero lower bound, if you happen to be in a situation where people want to save more than businesses want to invest, there's that problem, but you still get the equality. What happens is income falls. And so national output drops until the point at which total saving does equal total investment. And what happened is the way you knock down saving is people's income had to go away. So people are still trying to save a really high fraction of their income, but the absolute quantity of savings that occurs, you know, like measured in dollar terms, equals the absolute dollar term amount of investment, because so many people are out of work, they can't save that much. You see how that works? So the Keynesians reconcile it, and they say what they mean, what Paul Krugman means when he says right now there's excess savings, he doesn't mean the savings is larger than investment. What he means is if we had full employment, the interest rate would have to be negative to keep saving equal to investment. And since the interest rate can't be negative, what we end up having now, because necessarily savings equals investment, is that we have massive unemployment. to keep income below potential income, so that the lower level of income, the high fraction of savings that people want to engage in because of the uncertainty and everything, leads to an absolute quantity of saving that equals investment, which we know mathematically through accounting it must. So that's what Krugman's position is. The I think the typical Austrian position and more general free market position is that, yeah, savings equals investment, but not necessarily. That it's a, that savings, you know, is how much do people want to not consume out of their income, and then investment means resources that you're deploying for future enjoyments, and that those things conceptually are distinct. And so there's nothing in the laws of math or accounting that makes them equal each other, but that the equilibrating market process tends to bring them into equality. I think that's the way most Austrians. Now, I have a different view. I think they necessarily equal each other, but because I'm a hardcore, in my mind, subjectivist and individualist, and I'm going to say, if I, you know, so I get a paycheck, or I get, you know, I get paid $1,000 in cash, I go spend 900 of it on sushi and pay my landlord and whatever, that's clearly consumption, and now I've got $100 in cash left, what do I want to do with it? Everybody agrees if I go out and I buy a share of stock with it, you know, I buy a share of Microsoft for the $100, everybody agrees that I invested it, right, from my own perspective. And then you can quibble about from the macro economy that's just a transfer event, but clearly from my individual perspective, I invested that. If I go and take that $100 and buy a share of corporate stock with it. What I want to say, as the economist, not the guy in the story, what if I just put it in my cash balances? So I have that $100 bill, and instead of buying a share of stock, I put it in my wallet. Because in my mind, that's a better investment than buying the corporate stock. And I want to say from a praxeological point of view, using methodological individualism, methodological subjectivism, on what basis do I say, can we say that me taking my $100 bill and trading it for a share of stock and then putting that stock certificate in my vault, oh, that's clearly investment, but me taking the $100 bill and putting it in my vault at home, oh, that's not investment, that's just adding to my cash balances. Right? So there's a train of thought in the Austrian tradition that would, that says me accumulating that $100 bill is not investment. And I think there's, and I think that's a contradiction, because I think what I just said to argue that it is investment is unassailable. I don't think anyone could really object to that from the, given the reason you gave, but yet you run into difficulties, especially when Austrians are combating the Keynesians, about the difference between investment versus changing, you know, the composition of your cash balances and stuff like that. I got into a big brouhaha with Robert Wenzel on this issue. And at first I thought Wenzel was just totally wrong and then I was going to blow him up. And he started quoting Rothbard and I realized he had legs to stand on. In other words, there were lots of quotes from Rothbard that made it look like Rothbard wouldn't agree with what I just said. So when you ask me, does savings equal investment, I think yes, necessarily, because when you save, it means you're not consuming what you could. And when you invest, it means you take some resources and devote them to future ends. And so I want to say, if you're not consuming something, what are you doing with it? Well, you're necessarily devoting it to the future. Because if you don't devote it to the present, that's consumption. And so for me, you necessarily, praxeologically, your savings equals investment. But I think for a lot of free market people, that's not the way they think about it. They're thinking of it more like a macro, you know, aggregate resource point of view, and want to, you know, they want to come up with some mechanism that coordinates things, which is fine, and that's an important perspective. But I'm just saying, for me, in my mind, I'm being a radical subjectivist and saying it has to, savings has to equal investment no matter what. Okay, well, we're really out of time now. We got to stop. And Jan's last question, when's your next class besides the principles one? We don't know yet. It'll it'll be in the summer at some point, but Danny Sanchez and I are coordinating. I don't even know what the class is going to be frank. So we don't know yet. All right, thanks, everybody. Remember, you got your week 8 quiz. And then near the end of this upcoming week, I'm going to post the exam for the money in bank, or for Mises on Money in Banking, for those who are taking the course for credit. And I'll send out an email, obviously, to remind everybody of that.